So I haven't mentioned this to you before, but flying under the radar, Ukraine is the Antioch. Remember how Antioch sent out Paul? Antioch was the missionary capital of Asia Minor and the early church. Ukraine is the same way for Central Asia. So think Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. I call them the Stan brothers. I was deployed to Kyrgyzstan in 2013 at Manas and spent 6 months there in ministry. And the Muslim young men that are Muslim that come to Christ come out of Kazakhstan, come out of Turkmenistan, and they come. There's a Bible college and a seminary in Kyiv. I've had good friends that I've known that have taught in that Bible college and seminary. One of our missionaries that's in Poland from Tri-City, that's a very close friend of mine. He's been in Poland for 25 years. His name is Mike Peterson. He goes down to Kyiv, and he teaches in that seminary all the time. We call it Kiev. That's anglicized. It's really Kyiv, which is the capital of Ukraine. And this seminary has been amazing in the last 25 years. Of all of the pastors, it's trained and sent all over Hungary, of Moldova, Ukraine, Kazakhstan. It is under the gun, literally, if the Russians take over, because the Russians will not allow a gospel preaching and a gospel teaching training center to be that public. I mean, it's open, it's public, they preach the gospel. And the Russian Orthodox Church is in league with Putin because Putin has given them back power. So the Stalinists and the communists took the power away from the Russian Orthodox Church. But when Putin came to power, he lifted up the Orthodox Church and said, "I'll," a lot like what the Antichrist will do with what we think is probably the Roman Catholic Church, will align himself with a religious system to give him credibility before he turns on that in the tribulation. Well, Putin has done the same thing with the Russian Orthodox Church. The Russian Orthodox Church is one of the greatest persecutors of evangelical faith that's ever existed. We just don't hear about it because it's in the East and we're in the West. So the evangelical Christians, and Ukraine is the center for evangelical Christianity in that part of the world. The evangelical Christians are truly under incredible stress and distress right now with an imminent invasion because they will be targeted. And the Russian Orthodox Church has let the Russian army know who the Christians are in Ukraine and go find them. So anyway, it just adds another thing on our prayer list to remember. I think it was Paul who said, remember those who are in bonds, right? Remember those who are in chains. So good thing for us to remember. Comment or question about that, just as I kind of fill you. Yeah, so Russian Orthodox Church is an authoritarian church that has persecuted Christians for 1,500 years. It claims Christianity, but excuse me, it's just like a Greek Orthodox Church in that it believes in infant baptism, it believes in a work salvation, and it's authoritarian in the sense that it's tied to the state. So if you go back 50 years, for instance, the Greek Orthodox Church, if you went to Greece in 1960, even though it's a NATO country and a Western country, it was illegal for you to witness to anybody under the age of 18. It was illegal. So if you're a pastor in Greece, an evangelical pastor in Greece, and that's because the Greek Orthodox Church had gotten the government to outlaw proselytizing. And to an adult, if the adult was Greek Orthodox, you couldn't witness to them either. The only people you could witness to were gypsies, legally. Gypsies and Muslims in Greece 70 years ago, because the Greek Orthodox Church had made it illegal. Anybody under the age of 18, it was illegal. And if you were an adult and you were baptized into the Greek Orthodox Church, even if you never attended, you got baptized and never attended, it was also illegal. So if I gave the gospel to you at your age and you were in Greece 40, 50 years ago, and you were didn't even come to church, but I gave the gospel to you and you got mad at me for giving you the gospel, you could go to the authorities and they would come to my house and they would throw me in jail. The separation of church and state that we talk about as Baptists, we often take really for granted, because that was the Baptists that really influenced that in the early part of our country, religious freedom, religion of conscience, freedom of conscience. The world had never known that. Most nations, almost all nations, had a religious faith that was national, and the religious faith, whether it's Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Muslim, would say to the government, oh, these people are stealing people out of our faith, and the government would then be talked into persecuting them. Yeah. And today, the Roman Catholic Church, because it's in the West, has been, how can I say, overwhelmed with the freedom of conscience, because America has been such a strong force in the world as a superpower now for years, that this idea, but if you go 70 years ago in Mexico, evangelicals were tortured, were beaten, were arrested, and all those kinds of things. And now that's no longer true. They estimate in Mexico that maybe as many as 25% of Mexicans are evangelical Christians. There is actually a tremendous revival going on in Mexico and Central America when it comes to evangelical faith, because they've been Roman Catholic since the conquistadors, right? 500 years. And the younger generation growing up just sees it as just a vain tradition. They don't see it as having really any meaning or anything like that. It's just something that I do. But even 70, 80 years ago in Mexico, even though they had freedom of conscience on the Constitution, it really wasn't practiced. Christians were persecuted in Mexico. But that is not the case today, because there have been so many converts to Christianity. A little bit like the Roman Empire, there were so many converts, the empire couldn't function without allowing Christians into the mainstream of life. Does that make sense? Okay. Good deal. Let's jump into the end of chapter 11. I've just got a couple of verses left at the very bottom of chapter 11, verse 18. Jeremiah's life is being threatened now. So God is going to give him, and this is going to take us into chapter 12, and the conversation that Jeremiah and God are going to have. Now remember, this is taking place while Josiah is still alive. So these are the good times in Jeremiah's ministry. Jeremiah is probably mid-20s. So is Josiah. Josiah won't die for another 10 or 11 years at Megiddo. So these are the good times. The law has been discovered. They're about to celebrate the great Passover that we see in Kings and Chronicles. So when we get to God's rebuff of Jeremiah's complaint, you're going to understand that. Because remember, Jeremiah is not chronological. It's we just left being in about 607, and now we're backtracking. This is back to the future. So we're jumping back about 13 or 14 or 15 years, going back to 620. So this chapter is back just after Jeremiah has started preaching. It's when Josiah is still king. There's righteousness being mandated. And we read this in verse 18. Now the Lord gave me knowledge of it. Chapter 11, verse 18. Now the Lord gave me knowledge of it, and I know it. The it is the plot against his life. We're going to see this. So he is upsetting apple carts, to use an American idiom, right? He's upsetting apple carts. He is, even though Josiah is the king and he's buttressing Josiah's love for God, there are people that were like, wait a second, we've been doing this for 55 years and we've had Baal and Ashtaroth and the temple and we're covering all of our bases and we kind of like the lifestyle that we get culturally with worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth and adultery and fornication and sexual freedom. Almost sounds like the evangelical church today, doesn't it? Many years ago, I was standing in line in a grocery store in Tempe, and two young ladies in front of me were talking, standing in line. And I'm not one to eavesdrop, except when it's really juicy. And and so I would guess they're in the mid-30s. I was about my mid-30s at the time. And they were just going on and on about just life. And then the one says to me, so how is that? And the one says to the other girl, how is that moving in? How is that, that change in your life living with your boyfriend? So my ears perked up like a Missouri mule, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. So, oh, yeah, you know, we're having a, but it's been good. The last 6 months have been good. And, you know, chat. So they chat, and it's quite a long line. So we're there for several minutes, and I'm getting a whole story of their lives as they talk in front of me, you know. And we get up close to the front, and this, it changes. Conversation changes. And the girl asks the one that's living with her boyfriend, she goes, well, how's choir? Well, come to find out, they were both, one was teaching in the children's department, the other was singing in the choir. The one living with her boyfriend was singing in the choir of the largest evangelical church. It was 2 miles down the road from our church. They had 3,000 people on Sunday, and she's singing in the choir on Sunday and fornicating Monday, the rest of the week, with her boyfriend, living together. And then on Sunday, she's singing in the choir of this large evangelical church. I knew the pastor, preached the gospel, etc. So when I say it's almost like evangelicalism today, I'm there's a little sense of sarcasm, but there's actually a level of truth, which is how is it incongruent that I sing praises to God on Sunday and I fornicate on Monday? I mean, and I stood there and I was like, oh my goodness. How, either she's not listening on Sunday or the church knows and doesn't care. I said, it's just a bad at every single level. Well, that's where these folks were. They loved Baal. They loved Ashtaroth. And now you have this prophet who's telling them that this is wrong. And they still want to kind of do it under the, because they love Baal and Ashtaroth were sexually perverse deities. And he says, you showed me their doings, but I was like a docile lamb brought to the slaughter. And I did not know that they had devised schemes against me, saying, let us destroy the tree with its fruit. The idiom was, he was the tree, right? And the fruit was his message, his words. Let's get rid of the fruit and the tree. Let us cut him off from the land of the living, that his name may be remembered no more. And so God somehow miraculously revealed this. And we're going to see when God talks to him, God's going to say, don't believe their smooth words. So they were obviously plotting to kill him, but they were saying nice things to his face. They wanted to get rid of his message. But God reveals, don't listen to the smooth words. Don't listen to that. And he says, then Jeremiah says, but O Lord of hosts, you who judge righteously, testing the mind and the heart, let me see your vengeance on them, for to you I have revealed my cause. Boy, you can learn a lot out of that. Number one, let me just say this. We don't live in an era of, and here's, I'm going to teach you a big long word, imprecatory prayers. Imprecatory prayers. Does anybody know what an imprecatory prayer means? Does anybody want to help me out there? Go ahead. They're your favorite. So an imprecatory prayer is, I don't like Gene. Gene's kind of a scumbag. And I say, Lord, smite him hip and thigh. Just get rid of Gene. Okay, that's we see them in the Old Testament. This is an imprecatory prayer. Because the Old Testament was a different dispensation than today. Do you remember the story of the disciples that came to Jesus and they said, this town isn't listening to us. Will you call lightning from heaven and destroy them? And Jesus says to them, he says, you don't know what manner of man you are. So, what we do not take out of the Old Testament is imprecatory prayers. What is Jesus' command in the New Testament? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What is Paul's command in Romans? He says, pray for them that persecute you. Bless them that persecute you. There's no example in the New Testament of an imprecatory prayer. So as Baptists who see continuity between the Old and New Testament, but also a difference in the dispensation, we don't want to get out of Jeremiah's imprecatory prayer here that this is an example for us to follow. The same with David. David has imprecatory prayers all over the book of Psalms. They are completely legitimate for him as a king, as a civil leader, along with being a prophet of God in that dispensation. Absolutely, absolutely. But for us, bless them which curse you, bless and curse not. If your enemy's hungry, you feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. And in so doing, you heap coals of fire on his head, right? That's the New Testament ethic. Now that becomes a different ethic in a time of war as a nation. Then we're in don't get me off on that one. That's a different kind of just war theory and a different ethic. But for us personally, I don't pray imprecatory prayers at people. What I pray is God bless them. Now, blessing may be to a Christian who's out of step with God, blessing may actually be chastening, right? No chastening seems joyous for the present, but grievous. Isn't that what the author of Hebrews says to us? But in the end, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. So when I say to God and I pray for somebody that's out of fellowship with Him, clearly disobeying God, I mean, just walking away from God, and I can say, Lord, I pray that You'll bless them. As I look at that blessing, Lord, that blessing would be for You to chasten them, but You're God, and I'm not God. So, so what I don't want us to learn about Old Testament imprecatory prayers that pop up is I would just suggest they are not for us in the New Testament. The New Testament gives us a different dynamic in which to deal with people that persecute us. And it's not because we don't live in a theocracy anymore. The New Testament dispensation is not a church-state theocracy. It's a different dispensation. Okay, I don't mean to get in the weeds that far, but we're looking at imprecatory prayers. And I've heard Christian leaders stand up and pray imprecatory prayers in the pulpit, and I cringe because I'm like, okay, if you were in the Old Testament, that's good, but you can't find one time in the New Testament an imprecatory prayer. What you find is Christ on the cross saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, He prophesies their doom. He says, you know, woe to thee, Chorazin, woe to thee, Bethsaida, woe to thee, Capernaum, if the mighty works that have been done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago, and thou, Capernaum, which are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to hell. I mean, He prophesies their doom, but He doesn't pray for their doom. His personal relationship is one of, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah, go ahead.
The very foundation of the covenant God had with Israel is both blessing and curse.
Yes.
We will have that.
That's a really good point. Yep. Very good point. Exactly. So when I say the Ebal and Gerizim, the blessing and cursing, that's the point that our brother is making, right? that's a covenant with Israel that God will maintain. Do you remember? Okay, so now I'm going to chase a rabbit. Do you remember when Abraham falls asleep and God has him lay out the animals and cuts them in half, and Abraham falls asleep, and then God walks through the pieces while Abraham is asleep. Does anybody remember that story from the Old Testament confirming his covenant? Okay? Why? So here's the symbol. In traditional Old Testament era, when I made a deal with you, let's say I was going to buy Greg's house. Okay? And I agreed to pay Greg, you know, because he lives in an incredible house. I agreed to pay Greg $5 million for his house. I'm betting right now Greg would take that in a heartbeat. And I agree. So what we would do, have you ever bought a house? There's more pages to sign when you take out a loan and buy a house. You might as well, you know, give away the firstborn child naming rights or something like that, right? So instead of doing all that, what we would do is Greg and I would cut up animals. and lay half the animal over here, and half the animal over here, and half the animal over here, and half the animal here, half the animal, and half the animal here. And we would join hands, and we would walk between the animals. And that was a binding contract. Okay, a lot less bloody the way we do it, but it was good eating, you know. Why is that? The symbol is, if I don't keep my end of the bargain, you have permission to do to me what we did to these animals. Would get more people to pay their mortgage, would it? Right? That's the symbol. So what? Why does Abraham, are you remembering with me? Why does Abraham not, why does God put Abraham to sleep and Abraham doesn't walk through the pieces with God? What's that? You're almost there. You're like at the 1 yard line. We're going to hand it off and the Bronco running back will get stuffed at the goal line. And I know what's going to happen here. So, yes, it is a one-sided covenant. Because the covenant isn't dependent on whether Abraham is successful or not in keeping it. Yep. So normally you'd have two parties walk through. But was Abraham, I'm going to a point here. Was Abraham always, did Abraham always honor the covenant? No, he lost faith and went in and had sex with Hagar and we have the Arab race, right? He was not, were all of Abraham's children always 100% faithful to the covenant? No. God knew that. That's why God, who cannot lie, made a covenant with Israel that we, as dispensationalists, believe he will fulfill during the tribulation and in a literal millennium. Our amillennialist Presbyterian friends and Anglican friends and Lutheran friends, they don't believe that there's, they believe God has gone like this with ethnic Israel, and God has no future for ethnic Israel. And one of the strongest arguments we have is, wait a second, God made a covenant that wasn't based on whether ethnic Israel did it perfectly or not. God, who cannot lie, made a covenant with them, and he will keep the covenant. We as Baptist dispensationalists would say that covenant, there will be a great revival during the 7 years of tribulation when the church is raptured, and you have 144,000 Jews who I believe will start reading Matthew 24 and 25, in which Jesus lays out what the tribulation will look like. They will read Revelation 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, that lays out, and they're going to go, oh my goodness, we missed our Messiah, and we're in the middle of God working in Daniel, and God will open their eyes just as he did the disciples after his resurrection, and they'll go back to Daniel's 70th week, and they will go, oh my goodness, we're in Daniel's 70th week. Remember, these are all Jews writing about Jewish future. Daniel, Jesus, John, these are all Jews writing about what God's work with them is going to look like. So when we talk about a covenant, God made a covenant with them, with our Jewish, with the ethnicity of the Jews. That does not mean that the current Jewish state is perfect. It doesn't mean that they are sinless. That's not what that means. But God has made a covenant with ethnic Jewish people that he will not walk away from. He will not walk away from. But that's different than the New Testament era that we live in, which is a multi-ethnic. So they were to be light to the Gentiles. Remember, they were to live to the glory of God, be the visible manifestation of Jehovah. When they failed at that, God said, I'm going to create this new multi-ethnic organism called the church. And the Jews can be a part, and Paul talks about this, right? Romans 9, Romans 10, we're grafted in. The church is grafted in. So our ethic is, our ethic, not ethnic, our ethic, well, our ethnic is different in that we're multiracial. But our ethic is different in that, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I've said this often as I've been in the Middle East so many times. There is no God hanging on a tree, washing feet, sacrificing himself, and saying about his enemies, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," in Judaism or Islam. When I talk to my Muslim imams in the chaplaincy, and I talk to my Jewish rabbis, I say one of the differences in us is we believe that our God bore our sin and then forgave his persecutors. That is not the God of Islam. And that's not the Old Testament God that the Jews want to encapsulate. So they have an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth mentality. Well, when you're living in an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth mentality, as opposed to God, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," when you live in that mentality, your wars will go generation to generation to generation to generation to generation to generation. There is no end. That's why shalom is the word for hello, goodbye, peace. I mean, the word for peace is, so when you meet a Jewish person, I have many Jewish friends, the first word out of their mouth will be shalom, Mike. In other words, peace. But they won't know peace until they accept Jesus Christ as their Messiah and he rules and reigns. So I chased that little rabbit for a second, just so you'll understand it's legitimate for Jeremiah to have this imprecatory prayer, but that's not for us. Verse 21, "Therefore thus saith the Lord concerning the men of Anathoth." And I'll close with this. Anathoth is where Jeremiah was from. It was just a small village, probably no more than 500 or 1,000 people. This was Jeremiah's hometown. He had grown up there as a boy. It's about 5 miles north of Jerusalem. And in other words, the betrayal, it's not just that they were seeking his life. It's these were people, probably second and third cousins of his, fourth cousins of his, the neighbor down the street from him. I mean, if you're a village of 500 to 1,000 people, it's a small village. I mean, this is not very many people. And God lists that the Lord concerning the men of Anathoth who seek your life. His own family told him, "Stop prophesying or we will kill you." And this was when Josiah was ruling and reigning. They say, "Stop prophesying in the name of the Lord, lest you die by our hand. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, I will punish them. The young men shall die by the sword. Their sons and their daughters shall die by famine. And there shall be no remnant of them, for I will bring catastrophe on the men of Anathoth, even the year of their punishment." This would be literally fulfilled 35 years later. This will be literally fulfilled when Nebuchadnezzar comes. Anathoth is just completely obliterated. And my comment here at the end of my Jeremiah 11 is God reveals a plot against Jeremiah to kill him from his own small village of Anathoth. Very likely cousins and friends from when he was young were involved in this plot to kill him. And this prophecy against them would be fulfilled about 35 years later. So these men, their children and grandchildren are going to be obliterated because of their sin. One of the things that reminds us is our actions and our beliefs, they have second and third order effects for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. Don't ever forget that. How you live your life now impacts generations that aren't born. And how we talk now does the same thing. How we live, our value systems. These men were plotting to kill Jeremiah. And Jeremiah says in 35 years, many of these guys would be dead in 35 years. They won't live that long. They may have been in their 30s and 40s themselves. 35 years, they might be dead. But their kids are going to die, and God's judgment is going to fall on them. So, anyway, I didn't intend to spend that much time on Jeremiah 11, but let me talk to you a little bit about imprecatory prayers as we see them in the Bible. So, you'll see them in the Old Testament. And it's just important for us to remember that there is a reason why they're legitimate in the Old Testament, but they're not legitimate.